there's more to whiskey than just the liquor itself. Reed Mittenbuehler has written for The Atlantic and Slate about drinking culture, and in his first book, he's chosen to pick apart the complicated history of bourbon. Bourbon Empire, the Past and Future of America's Whiskey is out now, and WABE's Mike John spoke to Mittenbuehler about the myths surrounding the industry and whiskey's recent rise in popularity.
Georgia is one of those places that you talk about when you refer to craft distilleries popping up all over the place. And we have down here, we have 13th Colony out in Americus, Lazy Guy Distillery in Kennesaw. J.R. Revelry is based here in Atlanta. What accounts for this boom of interest in whiskey?
Right. You know, it's roaring back into resurgent popularity. And in the book, when we look at it, you know, whiskey used to be a very popular spirit in America. And then in the 1960s, 1970s, the industry just kind of cratered. And, you know, that's because baby boomers were turning away from, you know, the drinks of their fathers and their grandfathers. And today, I think the reason we're seeing this return to popularity is because, you know, this new generation is sort of turning away from the vodka and the lighter spirits and things that the boomers had gone to. And it coincides with this boom in craft food products in general. I think a lot of people, you know, it's kind of a way to take back control and tinker and sort of, you know, so that fuels a lot of it. And, you know, by 2000, almost 99% of all the whiskey in America was made by 8 companies, you know, 13 plants. And just in the past few years, we've had 500 to 600 new distilleries open all over the country. And those numbers are a little smushy. A lot of people are scrambling to get an exact number. They're opening almost every day.
Wow. Yeah, it's similar to the rise in craft beer brewing. Only with craft whiskeys, I suppose it takes a lot longer to. I mean, you have to age them for a number of years. So it takes does it take longer for those to come onto the market or?
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, one of the things we explore in the book is how craft whiskey is actually very different than craft beer. And early on, a lot of people were making, you know, the comparison, oh, craft beer revolutionized beer. But it's a little more complicated with whiskey. And I found that fascinating. That's one of the things I wanted to really get into in the book. A lot of whiskey geeks and people who are really into this are quick to point out it is different in so many ways. With beer, you know, you can have a product, first of all, the home brewing culture, you could experiment and really perfect your craft at home, and then you come out with a product, and in a couple of weeks, you know, it's ready for sale. With whiskey, you know, a lot of these, it doesn't have to be old or be better, but some of the most exceptional ones, you know, it takes the better part of a decade to make properly. And so you're seeing a lot of places come out, you know, with very, very, very young whiskeys. But, you know, this is a struggle, too, for them. You start as a company, and then you don't have a product for 5, 6, 7, 8 years if you really want to kind of reach a certain level. And you can see it throughout the history of this whole industry. You know, brands like Maker's Mark, they started in the early 50s, but their first product didn't hit shelves until way at the end of the decade. So that, in another way, it's interesting, like, because it's a struggle for them because it's such a, you know, it's a product that takes such a long time to make.
So you open your book, Bourbon Empire, with a story about a resolution that's passed by Congress in 1964. Which declared bourbon a distinctive product of the United States. I believe that's a direct quote. And
yes,
whiskey
yes.
producers, I mean, they really ran with this idea. But you open the story up and reveal sort of the machinations behind the industry side and the political side. Can you talk about that story and why you chose to open the book with that particular story?
Yeah, I love that story, and I chose to open the book with it because that quote, a distinctive product of the United States, it's been sort of reimagined as being America's native spirit. People started to misquote it. The words America's native spirit, they've got a much better ring to them. It's much better for marketing. And over the years, you've seen it kind of evolve into, you know, people think of it as, oh, you know, Congress gave this Valentine's Day card to the whiskey industry. But really, you know, the real story behind it was there was this liquor producer, his name was Louis Rosensteel, and he was he owned this company that was part of what was called the Big Four. It was a group of four companies that controlled about 75% of the liquor trade. And in the run-up to the Korean War, he expected major shortages like the United States had experienced during World War II. So he orders his distilleries to produce full blast. He's got a huge surplus of whiskey. And the Korean War ends without the shortages he had anticipated. And here he's got this product that is aging in barrels, but it's also evaporating. The taxes, by law, come due on it in 8 years. So he starts lobbying furiously to, you know, get this, it's called the bonding period, which is when you have to pay the tax, extended so that he doesn't go out of business. And if he goes out of business, he's going to take down huge portions of the business with him because everyone's also going to have to slash their prices to compete. He goes to the lobby group that he's a part of, and they actually oppose him. Although it's good for the product and good for the industry, they oppose him because they know he's going to use this older product to try to tap into luxury markets. So he's scrambling in the seat of his pants, trying to find ways to sell all the surplus. His profit is literally evaporating into the air as it ages. And so he gets the bonding period moved through lobbying, and then, you know, he turns to this resolution. He wants to get bourbon declared a distinctive product of the United States so that he can take it overseas and he can have international trade protections the way that champagne has or cognac has. He starts sending cases of it to embassies across the world because the U.S. market was pretty well saturated. And he was looking at overseas markets just to make money, and he died one of the richest men in the country. So, you know, this thing that has been reimagined as America's native spirit, I'm like, well, there's a great story of capitalism in there, too. And that's a big part of it, you know? And I love the story, and I love opening the book with that.
And, I mean, what do you think this illustrates about the industry?
You know, when you go to the store and you see, and it's a wonderful industry. You know, as I was, you know, researching this book, you meet all these wonderful people devoted to their craft, but there's also this other element. You know, you're always reminded that it's a business. So I told this kind of as a business story. You know, and when we say it's a business, I mean, even on the frontier, it was used as currency. It was a way for farmers to store the value of their grains. You know, that was a way to examine what I saw as a constant subplot to the overall story of whiskey in America. It's a humble product. You know, it's a very simple product. It's just some grains fermented and distilled, and then they're aged in a barrel until they're ready. They don't, you know, older's not necessarily better. It kind of finds its sweet spot in this sort of middle ground. It doesn't have to be expensive to be good, but because it's a business, you've had a whole history of folks, you know, looking at this simple, humble product and being like, man, how can we make people pay more for it? You know, so you look and they you know, started selling it in fancier glass bottles, or they start putting these terms that are really kind of meaningless, words like artisanal or craft or small batch, you know, telling very fanciful stories about the heritage behind the brand, many of which aren't always, you know, aren't true, to kind of strike chords with consumers in order to justify the business portion of it, which, you know, making money. And you still see that today, and I thought that was a lot of fun to look at.
So the story that we're sold by the advertising, by the labels, the stories on the labels of these bottles, it's generally not the real story of how the liquor got into the bottle. Right. To you, which of these narratives is more interesting to you?
Well, it's almost always the story behind the story that always has these little contradictions and the ironies that really make it great, but also involving the story of making up a story. And when I was looking back through the history of it, you find guys in the 19th century, like James Pepper, who's an icon in whiskey history. And he was making up stories in the 1800s about going back to the Revolution, you know, the heritage of his brand going back to the Revolution. And so you look at a brand like that today and you're like, you know, that brand has been recently brought back into existence. The trademark had lapsed and everything. And so you've got this whole history of people making up history. And so as people try to explain the histories today, it's like, well, what do we go with? The fake history he made up 100 years ago? Because now there's a very real history that's just as interesting that has followed on. And some of these producers who own some of these brands have said in interviews and other places, like, you know, it's not always the liquid that matters. It's the story. That's what they really trumpet. They're like, you know, these rules of connoisseurship, what is best, you know, what tastes best, that's all kind of arbitrary and subjective. But for creating a narrative and attaching it to these ideas of authenticity that I think people are really looking for today, that's what really sells it. It's what you buy into, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah, one word that is recurring in our conversation is authenticity. like other kinds of alcohol have embraced modern sorts of advertising. I mean, beer and vodka definitely come to mind. You know, we see these like really expensive and flashy ad campaigns for both of those things. So why does whiskey in particular tie itself so much to the past?
You know, part of it is I think because it takes so long to make all those products we just talked about. You know, rum you can age, but usually you don't age it that long. And when you're making a product that takes, you know, the better part of a decade in many cases before it's really at its peak, I think people want to know that the company that product is coming from have been around for a really long time. If it takes a long time to make, you kind of want that. So that's part of it. But another part of it too is whiskey has this special connection to U.S. history. And that, you know, we used to be, you know, when we were a colony, when it was a group of colonies, you know, we were a rum-drinking nation, and rum allowed the British Empire to kind of tie together all of its great points. You know, rum is made out of sugar, molasses, sugar byproducts. So, you know, those sugar products were made in the British West Indies, and then they're shipped to distilleries in places like Boston, which are these emerging industrial centers, and it helped the British Empire kind of control its territory, bring it all together. And then during the Revolution, those imports of sugarcane byproducts were cut off, and the United States started to shift looking at grains to make spirits to drink. So whiskey is very much rooted in the American Revolution that way. And then just a few years later, in order to pay for the war, you have the Whiskey Rebellion, which Alexander Hamilton designed this whiskey tax, and it favored bigger, larger producers. And then on the other side of the debate, you have Thomas Jefferson, who wanted to support, you know, these small farmers out in the frontier. And this debate erupts over this tax. And it really was kind of this battle to define the soul of American business, big versus small. And I think you see that same debate echo all throughout America's economic history. And you still see it today with our modern food politics when we discuss these things.
And for those folks who are concerned with the authenticity of their whiskey, I mean, if we could taste those bourbons that were being made back in the 1780s in the hills of Kentucky, would they be familiar?
No. I always like to joke, there's a very good chance, you know, we haven't tasted them, so there's really no way to know. But I always like to joke, you probably want the Frontiers whiskey about as much as you want the Frontiers medical care, you know, frontier dentistry. A lot of the product back then was unaged because brand names didn't exist back then. You don't really see brand names arise until after the Civil War. That's when they became prevalent. So back on the frontier, this was really just a bulk commodity. You didn't have producers who were producing it, you know, as a product to sell under their own name, attaching the reputation of their own name to this product. They were selling it to these wholesalers, and it wasn't aged, and it wasn't made by people who were necessarily caring, except in the cases where people were making it for their local limited consumption. And in those cases, okay, you know, I'm making it for my family and my friends, so they probably really, really tried a lot harder. But then even fast-forwarding past that frontier, you know, into the Gilded Age after the Civil War up until Prohibition, or actually up until 1906, when the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed, you know, a lot of the stuff that was being sold was horrible. It was adulterated with chemicals, poisons, you know, things like that, because the industry was unregulated. There were no rules around it at all, and people could put whatever they wanted into a bottle. And a lot of times they're trying to mimic the effects of aging by adding these poisons and then just putting whatever label they wanted on it and just selling it to you. So, you know, and then the Pure Food and Drug Act, which is essentially a labeling law, was passed. And, you know, so... And that's another angle we explore in the book. You know, sometimes, especially with food, we always like to romanticize the past and what we've lost. But, you know, sometimes it's worth taking a hard look. Was it really worth it? I mean, you know.
So what have you taken away from all of the work that you put into this book? What did you come away with?
You know, walking away from it, I remember thinking of the color gray. You know, it's like a lot of times we like to boil, you know, certain arguments down to just black and white. You know, big is bad, small is good, or small is bad, you know, what have you. And, you know, when I tell this story of the industry consolidating from thousands of producers down to just eight companies, you know, making the vast majority of it, a lot of people, they really recoil to that when I tell it. Like, I've punctured, you know, some idea they've had of what they really want to believe about the bottles and the brands that they're buying. But those companies actually do a very good job. And, you know, the new craft distillers that are coming on the scene today, you know, are going to bring a lot back that we've lost. So I'm very excited about that. But it wasn't that kind of conventional story you think of, oh, well, big is bad. These corporations are just duping us. Most of them are actually making an exceptional product to very high standards. They just work very hard to create that illusion that they're smaller than they are. But it's not a bad thing. You know, it's gray. It's not black and white. And I love stories that exist almost entirely in that gray area as opposed to being just one side or the other. So that was my biggest takeaway.
Well, Reed Mittenmuller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.